Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with reports today that the United States is adding military forces to the Persian Gulf just as Iran has announced missile tests. The former senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in the Obama administration, Vali Nasser, joins us to discuss both Pakistan's opening of supply routes into Afghanistan and the increased deployment of U.S. naval and air forces in the Gulf. Then we'll look into the connection between global warming and record heat spells in the east and wildfires in the west with Michael Oppenheimer, professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University and a longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. As extreme weather events become more frequent and destructive, we will discuss the growing urgency to deal with the reality of climate change. Then finally, Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City, joins us. He has an article at Salon.com, Romney Boosts Liberal Mormons, and we will discuss the growing divide between the conservative hierarchy of the Church of Latter-day Saints and younger, more liberal Mormons who embrace gay rights and the Mormon moment brought about by the presidential candidacy of Mitt Romney, who they feel is aligned with the conservative past, not the future of the faith. Joining us now is Vali Nasser, who is the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as a senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser. Are you there, Vali? I can't hear.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us, Vali. The New York Times, of course, is carrying a lead story in today's New York Times, saying that the United States has quietly moved significant military reinforcements into the Persian Gulf to deter the Iranian military from any possible attempt to shut the Straits of Hormuz and to increase the number of fighter jets capable of striking deep into Iran if the standoff over its nuclear program escalates. So is this some kind of posturing, or I thought the situation vis-a-vis the U.S. and Iran was de-escalating, but now what do we make of this?
Well, this is an old diplomatic tactic that whenever negotiations are stalling or if you want to get even more leverage out of negotiations, you put pressure on the other side, particularly military pressure, and that brings this attention focused on the consequences of the failure of the talks. You know, Nixon used bombing of North Vietnam and Cambodia to get the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong to make concessions at the peace talks. The United States threatened Milosevic with aerial bombing every time there was a impasse in the talks. CNN would show pictures of American B-2 bombers being rolled out of hangars and revving their engines in order to drive the point home to the Serbians to negotiate. So what we're basically seeing is that the U.S. Wants to make sure that the Iranians don't get too comfortable with the current flow of the talks and don't think that the threats that the United States initially made to bring them over into the talks are now off the table.
But I thought in the real world, if you will, where the rubber meets the road as opposed to posturing, that what was really biting on the Iranians is that they have lost, they're losing enormous revenues, they're losing oil customers, their daily output of right. oil has decreased by 1 billion barrels a day, and the oil sanctions haven't really kicked in, they're about to kick in. So in the real world, they're really things are starting to bite. So surely that's having more effect than military maneuvers in the Gulf.
That's absolutely true. That is having a bigger impact. But at the same time, we are also the Obama administration is threatening to escalate economic sanctions even further, and the threat of military force is sort of a multiplier effect in terms of pressure on Iran. But given also the other issue is that given the pressure that economic sanctions is putting on Iran, it's quite possible that the Iranians may lash out. They may decide that the sanctions are essentially economic warfare. They're going for the jugular of the regime, and as they have threatened to, recently, that they could again go after closing the Straits of Hormuz or in some ways try to retaliate. And partly the buildup of military forces in the Persian Gulf region is designed to deter the Iranians from any kind of reaction to the escalation of economic sanctions. So, you know, sanctions are getting to a point that they're becoming enormously painful, as you mentioned. Now you need the military capability also to make sure that the Iranians don't do something that would take economic pressure into actual confrontation.
Well, it's, I guess there's two ways to look at it. It's either extra leverage or may deter them, because the Iranian parliament announced on Monday that it would consider proposed legislation to disrupt traffic in the Straits of Hormuz. And they have said that Iran's military intends to block any oil tankers en route to countries that no longer are buying Iranian crude because of the embargo. Well, that's just about everything else that'd be going through the Gulf. That sounds quite provocative. Is that a realistic threat, do you think?
Well, I think it's not a realistic threat, largely because most of the countries that were buying from Iran are continuing to buy from Iran, except that it's just a reduced amount. The Iranians are also engaged in posturing. I mean, in reality, and this thing is going to be resolved when there is a realistic deal on the table that both sides can live with a little bit of leeway this way or that way. And all of the military threats by both sides or economic sanctions is merely it could merely serve the purpose of getting to a deal, but it will not produce a deal. Doesn't matter how much economic pressure we put on Iran or military threats we put before it, that could merely get the Iranians interested in a deal, but it's not a substitute for a deal. And we've seen in the past that it's quite likely countries like Iraq after the Gulf War that would be willing to accept enormous amount of economic pressure and ruination, in fact, and still refuse to budge. So what the United States has succeeded so far is to use pressure to bring Iran to the table and to get them serious about negotiations. The danger now is to confuse the pressure with an actual deal. In essence, we need to get a deal on the table that then we can leverage the pressure, economic and military, to actually get the Iranians to sign on to it.
Again, I'm speaking with Vali Nasser, who's the dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. And from 2009 to 2011, he served in the Obama administration as senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. So given that the sanctions are biting and that sending more military force into that very tense neighborhood with an Iranian regime that I think it's fair to say that it's pretty paranoid, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps that pretty much control the regime, they're extremely paranoid. There's questions as to how much the leverage is going to work and how much both sides are posturing. The New York Times in their front page story today are suggesting that this is in part to reassure Israel. And, of course, a lot of senior Obama administration officials in Israel have been saying that reassuring the Israelis that the president has all the options on the table. And when he says that, he means that. So how much is this meant to reassure Israel?
Well, to some extent it does, and some of the reassurance of Israel is really domestic American politics. It's the reassuring of the support base that Israel has in this country, that people who are worried about its security, et cetera, would like the United States to take a more decisive acts in support of Israel. So, you know, part of this argument is also directed domestic American public opinion is designed to fend off any accusations by the Republicans that the United States is putting Israel's security at jeopardy. Ultimately, the key question is that beefing up of forces is only meaningful if the Iranians really believed we would use them. And given generally our decision to be leaving wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and the mood of the American public about wars, I don't think it's a very a convincing threat to say that just when the American public is washing its hands of trillion-dollar wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that we would be jumping into a new one with Iran. And so I think, you know, I'm not sure how much of this convinces the Iranians about our determination to keep the military option on the table, as it probably assuages the critics of President Obama on the domestic scene that he's actually being very tough with Iran.
Well, you know, there's no mystery. The New York Times revealed that Mitt Romney is extremely close to Netanyahu, and nobody is closer to Netanyahu than Sheldon Adelson, the Las Vegas billionaire who's said he'll pump as much as $100 million in to get Romney elected. So I can't imagine that President Obama has any illusions about what side Israel's prime minister's on, right?
Well, you know, in reality, Iran currently is not really in its entirety a foreign policy issue. It is really a domestic policy issue.
Sure.
Because it's really the only foreign policy issue that the Republicans can potentially criticize President Obama over, and actually the American public would pay attention to and might may potentially decide to vote in the presidential election based on how they assess it. Afghanistan, Iraq, China, Europe, none of those issues evokes the kind of reaction domestically that Iran does. So in many ways, the administration's handling of Iran at one level is based on foreign policy logic of how do you bring somebody to negotiations and get them to make a deal and how do you make this threat go away.
Sure.
At another level is really managing the presidential election.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's turn to the area that you were dealing with as the senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan in the Obama administration up until last year, Vali Nasser. Obviously, it's connected in the sense that President Obama was unable to apologize to the Pakistanis for the U.S. military strike on a Pakistani border post that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers, I think in part because of election politics and Mitt Romney having framed Obama as the apologizer in chief. Now something has broken that deadlock. I believe that now U.S. and NATO supplies are now going to be allowed to transport through Pakistan into Afghanistan?
Yes. I mean, partly the president was not able to apologize because of the Republican pressure, but because the Pentagon was pressuring him that they should not apologize to Pakistan because Pakistan has been supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan and has been less than cooperative on counterterrorism issues and fighting against extremism. And they favored a policy of intense pressure on Pakistan, of cutting aid, of calling him out for their misbehavior in public. But over the past year, that policy hasn't worked. So the policy of pressure only that was favored by the U.S. military has failed. And the thing that the U.S. military itself cares about, which is access to supply routes into Afghanistan, protecting the drones program, fighting against al-Qaeda, all of those things that the military cared about were put at risk. So in some ways, this provided the president with much more latitude to basically say that, look, your approach hasn't worked, and the approach that was favored actually by the State Department and Secretary Clinton, which is you have to create a positive momentum in the relationship with Pakistan in order to get more cooperation from them than they would like to give, was probably more fruitful. So this opened the door to basically arguing that, you know, the relationship is going to collapse unless we save it. If it collapses, the U.S. military will be the biggest loser in this. And therefore, you have to go back to diplomacy. and find a way, find a language that both sides can live with, that is not a hard apology, it's a soft apology, but enough to give the Pakistanis political cover to be able to open the supply routes.
Well, Vali Nasr, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Good talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Vali Nasr, who's the Dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and he wasn't from 2009 to 2011, served in the Obama administration as the senior advisor to the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the connection between global warming and the fires in the West and the heat spell in the East.
Seen many hands, it has wealth and gold, yet it is fragile and old, and now the greedy souls just don't care to know all the changes it will confront. So speak out loud of the things you are proud, and if you love this coast, then keep it clean as it holds, cause the way that it shines may just dwindle with time, with the changes it will.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Oppenheimer, the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Geosciences and International Affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School and the Department of Geosciences at Princeton University. Previously, he spent over two decades with the Environmental Defense Fund and was a longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. Additionally, he's the winner of the 2010 Heinz Award, a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the co-author of the 1990 book Dead Heat, The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Oppenheimer.
Glad to be with you.
And it seems to me that we're losing the race against the greenhouse effect. I just spoke with somebody who took a cruise up to Alaska, and the Glacier Bay, when Vancouver discovered it, he didn't discover the bay because it was full of ice. And now you go 80 miles in and you see the ice melting. It's a stark reality, but it seems to me that there's still this wall of denial that's going on.
Indeed, there's no question that Earth is warming and that the signal, as scientists like to say it, is becoming more and more obvious. It's most obvious in the icy parts of the world. Arctic sea ice is shrinking in summer. Glaciers are melting worldwide. Parts of the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets are disappearing. But we see the changes down here at the mid-latitudes as well. And the U.S., of course, this week and last was in the grips of a very widespread heat wave. And the probability of that kind of event has already increased markedly due to the buildup of the greenhouse gases. And in fact, in the U.S., there's been many more record high temperatures set than record low temperatures in recent times. And in a world that wasn't warming, one would expect about a balance between those two. So there's no question the climate is headed in a dangerous direction.
Well, Michael Oppenheimer, it always bothers me that the weathermen on television, who are most people's access to this basic information about the weather, they sensationalize things. And every time it rains out here in California, they call it Storm Watch 2012 with a big drum roll, you know, and then we're lucky to get a few drops of rain. But the long and the short of it is that I wonder whether there's any way to educate the weathermen about global warming and start putting this stuff in context. Just sensationalism on a daily basis doesn't deal with the fact that I understand that just in this year alone, there have been 96 weather records broken.
Well, there are, in fact, a number of television weather people who do a very good job, and in fact do a good job on this particular question. And you have to understand that most of them are not experts in the climate, even if they know weather patterns rather well in many cases. And there have been many attempts over the years to bring together the professional community of TV weathermen with the professional community of climatologists who know quite a bit about global warming. And that's a conversation that needs to be stepped up, and there are efforts afoot to do so. I think over time that's a very important community, and your idea that they need to be engaged constructively in educating the public on this issue is absolutely correct.
So let's talk then about Michael Oppenheimer, about the connections between the wildfires in the West and the record heat in the East, and of course the enormous discomfort by the grid being down because of violent storms. I mean, just on that issue alone, one wonders about the kind of national security impact of this. You know, it seems like the weather is going to be doing more damage to the United States than any terrorist could dream of.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's certainly true that there is an economic cost to this problem, which has been ignored by and large by our policymakers in Washington.
So tell us about then the connections that...
Sure. What global warming does is it shifts the likelihoods of extreme events happening. So as time goes on, it becomes more and more likely that a heat wave that might have been very rare in the past all of a sudden starts happening more and more frequently. The frequency, the intensity, the geographic spread of events like the one we saw this week simply become more and more likely, so that a given event might have occurred once every 20 years previously, and in the future it might occur every other year or every year. An intense rainstorm of the type that might have occurred every 20 years might occur every 5 years in the future. A flood which might be produced by a coastal storm, which in the past might have occurred every 100 years due to sea level rise and intensification of the storm, might in the future occur every couple of years. And when you start adding up the impact of these events, including impact on human life, because after all, heat waves kill, one sees that there's a tremendous cost to the increase in these sorts of events. And again, global warming is kind of unnoticeable in the sense of the average temperature increasing a little bit, and it doesn't sound impressive. We're talking about Earth having warmed about a degree Fahrenheit so far, a little more. And over the century, warming something like 3, 4, 5 degrees Fahrenheit. But when you start looking at the effect on the extreme events, that's where you really see it. And more and more extremes will occur more and more often, and that's really where the damage is, the damage to society, the damage to human life.
And my understanding is that on the eastern seaboard, the ocean level has risen 3 inches. It's apparently more impacted on the eastern seaboard than it is on the west.
Well, in the last century, the global average sea level has risen about 7 inches. In the northeast, it's risen roughly twice that fast, and that's due to a combination of factors that have to do with both the local geology and the changes in ocean circulation that occur with the warming. And we foresee that sort of trend continuing, and the trouble with dealing with that is it's a latent effect. That is, a lot of sea level rise has already been built into the system by the greenhouse gases already in the atmosphere, and much of that has not manifested itself yet, and it's effectively irreversible. And the nasty thing about this problem is the lifetimes of the gases are so long that once they're emitted, they're going to be affecting the climate, not just for decades, but for centuries or even millennia. So decisions we make today on what to do about limiting the gases, or decisions we make to forego limiting the gases that are causing the problem, really have a an effect down the generations. So we have a responsibility to do something about that before things get out of control.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Oppenheimer, who is professor of geosciences and international affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School and the Department of Geosciences at Princeton University. He previously spent 2 decades with the Environmental Defense Fund and was a longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. And just in terms of putting some context to the record heat in the east and the fires in the west, apparently there have been 3,215 daily high temperature records set in the month of June. And since January the 1st, the United States has set more than 40,000 hot temperature records. So do you think we'll reach a point now where when this kind of information is reported, that it would be reported in the context of saying, you know, this kind of catastrophic weather brought to you by Shell, BP, and Chevron and Exxon?
Well, I don't want to predict what the media would do, and it's proven to be a little difficult to keep the media's and the public's attention on this issue, partly because the fact that the worst of it is manifest in extreme events, and extreme events themselves are episodes which don't happen every day. People, you know, their attention span is shorter. They have things that are more immediate, for instance, unemployment, health care costs, the cost of college tuition, you could name it. It's a long list. So that it's hard to keep this issue on the front burner. Nevertheless, I think over time, the damages that accrue will become so obvious that, people will finally decide that something serious has to be done about it. And in fact, a lot is being done. It's just not nearly enough to meet the challenge. The U.S. Emissions have not increased. They stopped increasing some years ago and have basically decreased. And that has to do with a number of factors like high energy prices. It has a little bit to do with policies implemented in Washington, like the higher fuel economy for motor vehicles. And the Obama administration has implemented some additional policies for restricting emissions from power plants. But it's really nowhere near enough. And we're only one country, although the second biggest emitter to China. So we have some substantial leverage on the global system. But this really is a not just a national problem, it's a global problem, and all people in all countries need to get together to settle it, and which is one reason I was dismayed the other day at the statement by Rex Tillerson, and this to bring it back to the question of what the fossil fuel companies are doing. He basically said, well, we'll just adapt to the problem. With the implication that there's no need to reduce emissions. And I think that's kind of an appalling view, which is ignorant of the real difficulties that this problem will bring about and that people just can't so easily adapt. So I think there's a long way to go in public education and engagement on this issue. On the other hand, human race has dealt with big problems, and I think grappling with this one is something that we have the capability to do. We'll just have to reduce our emissions.
Well, Michael Oppenheimer, not only do the oil companies, are they enjoying record profits, they do have enormous political influence. It's pretty clear that President Obama has not been able to get the Republicans to budge on massive subsidies that go to the oil companies who don't need them because they're enjoying record profits. And this money could go to alternative energies that don't create the global warming effect. So when I suggested that would there be a time when the public could make the connection between aberrant weather and the fumes that are coming out of the tailpipe of their cars and the extent to which the oil companies do a lot of greenwashing. They put up ads all the time on television telling us how much they care about the environment, but the enormous amounts of political money that they spend on Washington are designed to either deny global warming or to prevent any meaningful legislative efforts to do something about it.
I do want to add that there are degrees of behavior on this issue, and that some oil companies at some points have at least professed a relatively constructive attitude on the issue. I think rather than dwelling on on you know, self, the way political actors behave in the public arena in such a self-interested way, which is worth noting. We also ought to say that there are solutions to this problem, and that these companies, with their resources, should be leading the way towards solving the problem.
So what's your sense then of how the debate might change so that our awareness on this planet catches up to the extent to which the planet is threatened?
Humans make progress in fits and starts and in peculiar ways. And, you know, there was a piece of legislation which passed the House, which was a comprehensive attempt to deal with the problem during 2009. It didn't make it through the Senate. U.S. policy got gridlocked after that, but nevertheless, there's a lot of progress that's been made at the state level on this issue. And there's been, as I said, some federal regulatory effort because it didn't have to go through the Congress to implement. Some companies are taking measures to become more efficient, mostly from the point of view of saving money. And individuals take steps all the time to reduce their energy use for the sake of not just the environment, but their own personal economy. So there's a lot to work with out there. The problem is that there's been no overall attempt in the United States to bring it all together in a comprehensive solution, the way the Europeans say have implemented the Kyoto Protocol, which is reducing their emissions substantially. So we await the political leadership that will lead us in that direction. There was early in the Obama administration an attempt at that leadership. Then they moved on to other problems like health care. And I would hope that in his second term, if he has one, or in the first term of whoever succeeds Mr. Obama, that there is a serious attempt to solve the problem in true national leadership on this.
Well, hasn't there been an example made by the Germans in this, Michael Oppenheimer? Not only have the Germans given up nuclear power, but they are rapidly replacing nuclear power with wind and solar. And they live in a northern climate that doesn't have a lot of sunshine.
Yeah, there's been a lot of progress in Europe, not just Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, and some of the other countries in the EU have implemented strong policies to induce the development of the implementation of renewable energy. Those are the kinds of policies which, or their analogous policies could be implemented here. State of California is doing a pretty good job of pushing things along. California's always been very high in their energy efficiency, which is good because it cuts emissions. And now with the implementation of the greenhouse gas legislation of a few years ago, the state is again making a move in the direction of slowing the growth in emissions. None of it is quite enough. Emissions don't just have to be stabilized. They have to be sharply reduced. And we're nowhere near getting there anywhere except in the EU. The emissions have started to significantly decrease in some countries. But, you know, the point is we see the ways that it can be done. We know how to do it. This isn't a mystery. It's not going to bankrupt the economies. In fact, if we can move through the fossil fuel era, we'll all be better off for a variety of reasons. Get rid of air pollution, get rid of dependence on imported energy, reduce our political dependence on countries abroad that we'd rather not have a political entanglement with. For all those reasons, it would be a good thing to start that transition sooner than later. We know how to do it, and when the political will gets together, I think it could happen rather quickly.
So in the meantime, how does one deal with, for example, John Christie at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, who's a global warming skeptic? He's suggesting that the fires and the record heat and floods, et cetera, that are happening with greater frequency, his answer is, the guilty party, in my view, is Mother Nature.
Well, everybody's entitled to their view. He just happens to be wrong in this case. And the preponderance of the scientific evidence and the preponderance of scientific opinion at this point is that the frequency, intensity, and extent of these sorts of extreme events is increasing due to the buildup of the greenhouse gases. You can't in the case of any one event, you in general can't point to that event and say this was caused by the greenhouse effect. But you can say that events like this are increasing in their strength due to the buildup of greenhouse gases with a very high likelihood, particularly for heat waves. And everything that follows from heat waves, including people dying of heat stress and forests exploding into flames. So I think the argument is settled, and we need to move beyond those contrarian views to try to figure out how to get the political will together to solve the problem.
Well, just in closing, my understanding, when you talk about Mother Nature being at fault, it seems to me that Mother Nature, in fact, has built in a warning system that it means that if we don't address it, it exponentially gets worse, because as the ice cap melts, the less heat is reflected from the planet because the dark ocean it replaces the white reflective ice cap. And unless, for example, we paint all of our roofs and our roads white, we have to find some way to reflect that sun back. And my understanding is when the tundra melts, it's just built in that as more global warming happens, that nature will, by its nature, accelerate the process. Is that right?
What you're talking about are so-called positive feedback.
That's right, yeah.
There are many of them. And we believe that on the whole they are stronger than the so-called negative feedbacks, which tend to have the opposite effect and tend to stabilize the system. So on the whole, it does look like as we warm the Earth, we'll accelerate the warming, because more warming will beget more warming. That's one reason why it's critically important to try to act now rather than later, because it looks like as we pour more heat into the system, the responses will get larger and larger proportionally.
Well, that's dire enough, I would think, for people to recognize that we're running out of time here. And it's kind of difficult to look at your kids today and think about the kind of world that they could have unless we deal with this.
Well, that's right, and, you know, I'm a parent, and I feel the same thing. On the other hand, I am also aware, I'm not a pessimist, because I'm aware that the human race has both created for itself many challenges and faced them down many times, and the human enterprise continues in some ways to thrive. So I don't give up hope at all, and I think it's a matter of focusing the collective mind and doing what we know how to do. And I am confident we will do so.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Michael Oppenheimer.
It's been a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Michael Oppenheimer, who's the Albert G. Milbank Professor of Geosciences and International Affairs in the Woodrow Wilson School and the Department of Geosciences at Princeton University. Previously spent over two decades with the Environmental Defense Fund and was a longtime participant in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2007. And he is the co-author of the 1990 book Dead Heat, The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Salt Lake City to talk with a Mormon liberal.
Is made of testaments old and new. You've been told it's just those two parts, or only one if you're a Jew. But what if I were to tell you there's a fresh third part out there, which was found by a hip new prophet who had a little Donny Osmond flair.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radio Active, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He is a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune recently named as the gay mayor of Salt Lake City, and he recently appeared in the Errol Morris film Tabloid. He has an article at Salon.com, Romney Boosts Liberal Mormons. Welcome to Background Briefing, Troy Williams.
Hi, Ian. Hi, L.A. Good to be back.
So a group of Mormons on the weekend, I was just reading this online, staged a protest to excommunicate themselves from the church, which apparently is a difficult position to do. And it's a courageous thing for people to do because quite often they lose their jobs since the Church of the Latter-day Saints employs a lot of people. And apparently it's something that you do at your own professional risk, getting out of the church. These people apparently climbed up to the top of a mountain peak where the founder of Salt Lake City, Brigham Young, apparently built a church and looked out upon the Great Salt Lake, etc. So it was full of symbolism. So let's just deal with that for a minute before I get on to talking about your article at Salon, Troy. Why are people going to these lengths to try and make a statement to the church hierarchy?
Well, it's definitely a symbolic act of protest. Mormonism, the way that it's structured, it is a top-down, patriarchal, sometimes autocratic institution. And so voices from the grassroots, voices from the margins, don't really have a say in church governance. It's certainly not a democracy. So it's very difficult for a lot of frustrated Latter-day Saints to get their message out. So one of the ways to do that is to get the media together, go to a symbolic place. And in this case, it was Ensign Peak, where Brigham Young famously declared, "This is the place," when he was settling the valley. And they signed a Declaration of Independence from Mormonism. And the press was right there, and they were able to really get the attention of the church. They don't like the way things are going.
And obviously the church has come into focus, and largely the reason I'm talking to you is because the presidential candidate on the Republican side, Mitt Romney, is a Mormon. He's a Mormon bishop and was a stake president, and apparently is a fairly prominent member of the church. And questions have arisen about the extent to which the Mormon Church will be an influence over this candidate if he is to become president. Jack Kennedy, of course, when there was a lot of anti-Catholic bigotry when he was running for president, made a very, very strong statement about the separation of church and state.
Right.
Mitt Romney has not done anything similar. In fact, he's done the opposite, saying that the country is too secular. So he has abandoned the political cover that Jack Kennedy gave him.
Right.
Yet at the same time, he's never really spoken about his Mormon faith and how important it is to him.
That's correct. And in fact, you know, I actually wish that Romney's faith would influence him more. You know, he's getting so friendly with the money changers at the temple. Instead of kicking over the tables, though, he's sitting down with them and saying, "How can I make life easier for you? How can I increase your profits while the rest of America struggles?" And I think Romney, like so many of the so-called Christian GOP, they've co-opted the message of Jesus, grossly perverted it for their own agenda of corporate welfare, privatization, tax cuts for the wealthy, all the things that would be anathema to the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's who Romney is.
Well, it's, I guess, some embarrassment to him that one of his big fundraisers, who was the co-chair of a big fundraising gala, was the representative here in the United States of Barclays Bank.
That's right.
And I did an interview yesterday with an economist in London about the egregious behavior of Barclays Bank in terms of this Robin Hood in reverse, how they, along in complicity with traders, were rigging the interest rates on muni bonds, ripping off towns and cities and pension funds in order for bankers and traders to make huge bonuses. So it's not difficult, I think, to make a connection between Mitt Romney and the money changers. But why do you think people in this country would vote for him? And the polls indicate that it's going to be very tight.
I think a lot of Republicans, even folks who are very suspicious of Mormonism are going to hold their nose and vote otherwise because it's better than the black guy, right? The black Kenyan Muslim who's not a Christian will vote for the Mormon who's not a Christian. I think that the right wing is in just a real pickle right now about what they're going to do. But I think at the end of the day, they will vote against their best interest, and Republicans will. Poor working class Republicans will vote against their best interest and against what their best wishes, and they'll vote for Romney.
So we also have here in Hollywood, Troy, it may seem a lot like a bit of a tangent here. A lot of the entertainment press are in a Twitter about Katie Holmes splitting from Tom Cruise. And then who of all people should throw their weight into the Twitterati conniptions over this is Rupert Murdoch, the press mogul. Who
right.
gratuitously mentioned that Tom Cruise is very high up in the Scientology hierarchy. He's maybe number two or number three. And this, of course, has long time been rumored that he's had a gay relationship with David Miscavige, the head of the church. And I think that's probably what Rupert Murdoch was hinting at to justify this tabloid question, Troy. There is a strange kind of connection, is there not, between Scientology and Mormonism, the extent to which Scientology was written by a science fiction writer. It's
right.
L. Ron Hubbard. And my understanding is that the Book of Mormon, many historians say it was plagiarized from Solomon Spaulding's book about Romans arriving in pre-Columbian America.
That's View of the Hebrews, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that he, Solomon Spaulding, of course, was a 19th century science fiction writer. So,
right. Well, a lot of people have referred to the Book of Mormon as kind of Bible fan fiction in a way, which I think is probably pretty accurate. And yet you can't deny the power of a story. The historicity of the Book of Mormon aside, which we know isn't, you know, the Book of Mormon, though it pretends to be a history of ancient America, we know it's a 19th century document, and yet it has this power to actually really infuse a people to actually bear great hardship to actually cross the plains back in the early 1840s. And so it is this powerful, kind of creates this powerful meta-narrative that actually binds the people together. Mormons, you know, we can make fun of Mormons all you want over, you know, the ways that they treat gays and women, etc., but they really do know how to cultivate a real deep sense of family, a real deep sense of community. And when you leave that, as these people have who signed this Declaration of Independence from Mormonism, there's a great social cost to it, and it is painful for the people who exit.
And isn't there a professional cost as well?
There are general authorities who are actually, you know, paid to lead the church. Yes.
So what would
I'm sorry. You asked me if there are professional costs, right?
Yeah. In other words, my understanding is that it's not good for you professionally to leave the LDS Church.
It depends where you're at. You know, Salt Lake City is a really progressive town that really does not have a lot of Mormon influence. We have always elected progressive mayors. We haven't elected a Mormon or a Republican in over 30 years to be mayor of Salt Lake City. So if you're actually in Salt Lake, you're probably okay. But if you're in these pockets like Provo, Utah, where, you know, it's like 90% LDS, it can be devastating to your professional career to leave the church. Absolutely.
So, you know, just not to belabor the Scientology Mormon connections, I mean, there was a prominent Hollywood screenwriter, director, Paul Haggis. There was a profile on him in New Yorker. He quit Scientology because they supported Prop 8, which was largely supported by the Mormon Church, was it not, here in California?
Organized and funded from Salt Lake City, Utah. That was, you know, sadly, that was our gift to you in California, yeah.
Again, I'm speaking with Troy Williams, the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. And he's a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune recently named the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He also appeared in Errol Morris's film Tabloid, and he has an article at salon.com. Romney boosts liberal Mormons. So let's talk about the last gasp of liberalism, if you will, in terms of the Mormon Church's hostility towards gays, and get back to how much it's changing.
Yeah, 1993, one of the members of the Quorum of the Twelve Apostles, Boyd K. Packer, declared that there were three great enemies to the Mormon Church. One was the feminists. Second were intellectuals or scholars, and the third was the homosexual movement. And it's been really fascinating to watch this Mormon moment, as it's being called, as the media is really sort of exploring all the strange facets of Mormonism, and these voices have been emerging. And they are emerging within the church. And right now, because of the high profile of Romney running, these voices are able to sort of flourish in a way they haven't been able to do traditionally because of fear of excommunication. So members are stepping out and verbally, vocally saying, I support the LGBT community. I'm not okay with what happened with Proposition 8. And what we saw, me and one of your guys, Hollywood screenwriter Dustin Lance Black, in our Pride Parade, at the beginning of June, we marched at the very front of the parade with 300 active Mormons called Mormons Building Bridges. And they were dressed in their Sunday clothes, and they stepped out. Now, this is unprecedented for active Latter-day Saints to step out and say, hey, we love you. We love you for who you are, not in spite of who you are. And this prompted marches in gay pride parades of Mormons all around the country, from Seattle to New York to Washington, D.C., Cincinnati, Minneapolis. Mormons were coming out to, I think, in a way, in a kind of penance, really, I think, because they have been ashamed and embarrassed by how the gay community has been treated by their church, and they're saying, we love you, and we're taking a stand, and we're marching with you. And that is really exciting, and it's unprecedented.
Well, my daughter is a millennial, and she has a lot of young Mormon friends who are extremely liberal and absolutely want no part of anti-homosexual prejudice. They're completely over that, and I imagine that's a growing influence within the LDS Church.
Yeah, you know, in fact, just recently, a retired church historian and a general authority, Marlon Jensen, he was meeting with a group of LDS college students, and he publicly acknowledged that young people are leaving the church in droves. They're leaving because, you know, women leave because there's no parity with men in the ecclesiastical structure. They're leaving over Prop 8 and the treatment of gays. They're leaving because the church has hidden their history from them. A lot of Mormons grow up never knowing that Joseph Smith was a polygamist, that he had multiple wives, some teenage girls under the age of 16, 14.
Wasn't he shot by cuckolded husbands?
No, he was shot by an angry mob, though there were other Mormon authorities in the day who were shot by husbands who could, because they had, like Parley P. Pratt had taken the wife of someone, and he came after him and shot him. So this history has been hidden from them. I mean, sometimes the first time that some Mormons knew that Joseph Smith translated the Book of Mormon with magic stones and a hat, the first time they saw that was in a South Park cartoon. And so when young Mormons see this history that's been hidden from them in Sunday school and in their seminary classes, it's a deep sense of betrayal. They get angry, and they walk. They leave in droves. And the church recognizes this, and I think that there are people within who are working desperately to change the culture within the church. Can they do it fast enough? I don't know. But I do want to give props to the LDS Church in one area. They have reached out to the gay community, the leadership of the gay community. They have entered into dialogue with us. And it's me, Dustin Lance Black, several other local leaders here in Utah, and saying, how can we make things better? How can we improve? How can we find common ground? And we're now in dialogue with them, and on many levels, not marriage, but on many levels, they are receptive to the conversation. So there is some reason to have hope.
So we've seen what the backlash in Mormonism is to Romney, to the kind of conservative corporatist candidate for president. Again, I wish the press were able to engage Mitt Romney in more of a discussion about his religion, which he clearly values, and get more of a sense of it, because he's basically keeps ducking that. And do you think that people like you are going to force Romney into talking more about his religion, and particularly the struggle within his religion, from the liberal minority like you and others? That, you know, I mean, the last time I talked to you, you had an article about how the roots of Mormonism were quite socialist.
Right. You can go through Mormon history and really, you know, the religiously pious can pull from whatever elements they want to justify their own dogma and doctrine. But when I read the Book of Mormon, I see a text, whether Joseph Smith made it up or not, that's aside the point. But what the actual content of the text says is that we have a commitment to the poor and the needy first. The Book of Mormon, a third of the Book of Mormon deals with war and a doctrine of just war. And I'll tell you what, Mitt Romney is surrounding himself with people from the Project for a New American Century, the neocons like Robert Kagan and John Bolton, and people who believe in the doctrine of preemptive war and Pax Americana, building a full-spectrum military dominance around the globe. The Book of Mormon clearly teaches that that is anathema to the will of God. Preemptive war, aggressive war, is forbidden by God's people in the Book of Mormon. So if Romney were really a man of faith and really inspired and motivated by his sacred text, which he says he is, he wouldn't be surrounding himself with the neocons. Absolutely not.
Well, just in closing then, Troy Williams, do you think you're going to smoke Romney out? Do you think there's a way to engage him in this dialogue?
I hope more people like you, more journalists, will really ask the hard questions. He is a master of evasion and a master of saying whatever he needs to say. And I'm really a master at appealing to the lowest common denominator of the Republican Party. So am I hopeful about that? No. But what I would like to see is I'd like to see Mormons, rank and file Latter-day Saints, standing up in their congregations, in their Sunday schools, and saying, we support and love the LGBT community. We want equal parity with women in our church. We want a commitment to the poor. And actually, we want you to actually hold true to the core gospel of Jesus Christ. And if Mormons did that, they would be a powerful force for good in this world.
And in terms of Romney being described as the liar in chief, which I spoke to an analyst who wrote an article in, I think, in Foreign Policy about that. I also had John Dean of the Watergate on, former Republican, a couple of days ago on the Supreme Court decision. And he just, without any prompting from me, mentioned that he just can't stand the fact that Romney lies all the time.
Yeah. Now, that tells you he's not committed to his faith. Thou shalt not lie. Mormons do believe in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not bear false witness. And he fails every time.
Well, Troy Williams, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Great, Ian. Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Troy Williams, who's the executive producer of Radioactive, a progressive talk show on KRCL-FM in Salt Lake City. He's a former Mormon missionary who the Salt Lake Tribune recently named the gay mayor of Salt Lake City. He's also appeared in the Errol Morris film Tabloid and has an article at Salon.com, Romney Boosts Liberal Mormons. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Brooke Peterson. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.